Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and today we are in episode number, oh gosh, John, I can't see it. What episode number are we on? Come on, help me out, man.
Wait, is this episode 69?
Is it episode, no, 63. Episode 63, we're on movie number 38. I know, I couldn't even see it. I'm sitting here and I'm like, I don't have it in front of me. It cuts it off halfway through. I should be more prepared. But today we're talking two war movies, Battleship Potemkin from 1925 and The Pianist from 2002. I went on a war movie binge this week. They could not have been any more different, and I can't wait to discuss that when we get to it. But John's movie is Battleship Potemkin. Mine is The Pianist, my first of three Roman Polanski movies that appear in my top 38. The only three movies that I have by him on my list, and I love all of them. You have Battleship Potemkin, which kind of sets in motion your 1920s Russian cinema trend, which we're going to see a lot coming up.
I mean, to be fair, there are only two 1920s Russian cinema films, but yeah, we're hitting my Russian cinema films in the next over the next 38 episodes here.
Can't wait. Haven't seen Battleship Potemkin since college. Not sure if I saw the whole thing. They always show the Odessa step scene, and they always forget to show the rest of the movie. I don't know if I've seen the whole thing. I don't know if this is my first time. I've seen enough of it to know what the movie was, know what I was going into. But this was definitely the first time I really like watched it. What I was most amazed about, it's an hour and 10 minutes. Love that. Thank you. Yeah. Can people start making more of those? So John and I don't have, I don't know, next week, where we have the 3-hour Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and the 2-hour Ordinary People, which we then follow up with the 4-hour Seven Samurai and the 2-hour Usual Suspects. But maybe we should have more hour and 10-minute movies on our list. I thought that was very pleasing, especially for a silent movie. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to get into my little like spiel before we get into this. But because we were doing Battleship Potemkin this week and I saw how short it was, I decided to watch Birth of a Nation because I'd never seen it. And I was really curious more than anything. D.W. Griffith, 1915, most controversial movie probably ever made. But it's also probably the most groundbreaking movie ever made. So I wanted to watch that and then watch a Russian cinema movie that came 10 years later. Birth of a Nation is 3 hours and 24 minutes long. Battleship Potemkin is an hour and 10. Just let that sink in and look at which one I gave a better review. I don't think people really understood. And I think it's impossible to ever understand. It's the same thing as people thought Avatar was going to stand the test of time, and 3 years later, it looked like shit. People didn't understand that audiences weren't going to have the patience for silence for that long. And I think a movie like Battleship Potemkin excels because it was shorter. So, John, tell me, why'd you throw this one in here as your number 38?
Battleship Potemkin probably has a bit of like Stockholm syndrome for me when it comes to how much I've fallen in love with this movie over the years. When I started at university, I was doing a Slavic studies degree, and I watched this movie 8 times in my first 2 years in university, just from various classes showing it. And it was in its entirety because conveniently it fits in the time that you were in the lecture. So I saw it so many times, and then I started watching it on my own and showing it to friends and stuff. And I was like, oh, I guess I really enjoy this movie. And what it comes down to is Sergei Eisenstein is one of the most influential filmmakers of all time. Mm-hmm. This film is one of the most influential films of all time. And the fact that it's just this nice 70-minute story that's so easy to follow despite being a silent film, it's so engaging. It never lets up the entire movie. And it's a propaganda piece, and it does its job. You feel really riled up at the end of this movie.
Well, and I always find it interesting that this is considered a propaganda piece, because it is. But at the same time, like, this is a very anti-communist, anti-everything that's going on in Russia, anti-war movie. So it's a propaganda piece, but for anti-war.
But you have to keep in mind, like, the time period when this movie came out. This came out in 1925, right? We're right on the heels of the Russian Civil War following the Bolshevik revolution. So we're at a time where Lenin is trying to ease people into communism, right? He's pulled back with his new deals and everything, and is with the new economic plan, and is now pushing towards like going full communist, but he needs to get the workers there. And that's what this movie's really showing. We see Eisenstein right from the get-go establishes the fact that the higher-ups in the military are evil. They are bourgeoisie, ready to... They don't care about any of these underlings at all. They are just there to do their job, and they're there to make everyone else do theirs. Mm-hmm. And immediately we get this character of a Vakulinchuk, who's just all who's ready to rile up the troops. He's that everyman hero that we see a lot in these Soviet era films. Mm-hmm. That is just communicating with everyone and being like, "Hey, we don't have to stand here for this."
Yeah,
and just is this rallying force for all of these people, and it's just it's so engaging. It's so. I think one of the biggest scenes in like that first section of the film, when we get the maggots, oh, these are maggots. They're not worms.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just goes to show exactly how terrible these higher up people are on this ship. And that's where the propaganda is coming from in this is this movie isn't supposed to be riling people to revolution. The revolution's already happened. We're past mm-hmm. that point. This movie is to reinforce the idea that communism is the correct way to the future for Russia.
So this is a pro-communist movie.
Very, very.
See, that's what's funny to me because I was watching it as it felt like it was anti just because it was the guy who was going against the war and everything like that was the hero. But I think so. So here's what's interesting, though. If you don't know the history of Russia mm-hmm. and you don't, cause I don't really know it that well. I mean, I don't really care to be completely frank. Like, you know, it's just one of those things like you're very into it. There's a lot of people who are like, why do you like movies? I don't know. I just do. But Russian history doesn't enthrall me. It just doesn't. However, not really knowing much about Russian history, aside from the fact that it was a communist country for a very, very long time. And, you know, then it kind of moved away and now Putin's doing whatever Putin's doing. I felt like this movie was anti-communist because of the way it was presented, which it was presented as for somebody who doesn't have the history of Russia. Mm-hmm. It was presented as power to the people, not the government. And we don't need war. But in reality, what you're saying is, it was telling you we need to unite behind communism in order to move forward. Because if we unite, we're taking down not the communist leaders, we're taking down the leaders pre-revolution, is what you're saying.
Yes, and no. You kind of have to have like you have to understand the philosophy behind communism and like the Soviet idealism that was going on at the beginning of the Russian Revolution and mm-hmm. the beginning of that Soviet era, in which the idea wasn't that there were going to be Soviet leaders. Ideally, like Lenin didn't want to lead. He just noticed the necessity of it as a transition. The whole idea in like communist doctrine mm-hmm. is that it's more of an anarchistic society where there is no governing government at all. The reason why we don't equate that with Soviet Union is because after Lenin died and Stalin takes over, he really pushed the dictatorship in Russia and pushed that there was this mm-hmm. Soviet leadership that was controlling everything. And that's what you had to kind of worship. Whereas we're looking at, first off, this movie takes place in 1905. So important historical context for this film. We have the Russian-Japanese War, the Russo-Japanese War happening right now. Which is why we get the mention of like, you know, prisoners in Japan are making war. Mm-hmm. Russia and mm-hmm. Japan do not like each other at this time in history. Mm-hmm. Russia infamously loses this war with Japan. We have Russia's very far behind technologically from a lot of countries at this point. Mm-hmm. We're still talking like, while we have like the Industrial Revolution happening or having happened and we're seeing modernization in a lot of countries, Russia is still like very much like plow and oxing their fields all the time instead mm-hmm. of having tractors and everything like that. So Russia's a very like far behind in when it comes to modernization. The Tsarist rule is really getting on the nerves of some people. And 1905 was the first Russian Revolution.
Okay.
So there was a Russian Revolution that happens in 1905. It's the same one that's depicted in Dr. Zhivago. Mm-hmm. Is that 1905 revolution when the
and Dr. Zhivago is a very well. I just sorry to interrupt, but Dr. Zhivago is a very anti-communist movie.
It is
and a very anti-communist story, but it's still told in the same fashion of those without the power seeking power, which is why this movie to me, as somebody with limited knowledge of mm-hmm. Russian history, feels on the surface level like it's actually anti-communist when it's actually pro-communist. Because to me, I'm just like, well, those must be the communists.
Right. Because what we're seeing, it's that difference in time period, right? Dr. Yeah. Zhivago is a story that's written post-Stalinist Russia, whereas this is a pre-Stalin film. This is a film that is, like I said, it's coming off the tails of the Russian Civil War, which was the Reds, the Bolsheviks, going against the Whites and taking control of the country. Mm-hmm. And what we see here is this is that idea of, you know, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, right? Like, this is like that classic Marxist thought process here. And that's what we're seeing in this movie. We're not seeing an overthrowing of, we are seeing an overthrowing of the governing party, but the governing party is czarist here. It is because it's 1905, right? It's a czarist governing party. This is not a communist party that their people are rising up against. This is the people uniting to become communist.
I think it's so interesting. Like, so it's funny because my biggest problem, and I don't know how it is in other countries because I've never been to a college in another country, but I learned this very quickly when I was doing my master's. My biggest problem with secondary education in America is that they do what they think they're supposed to without really explaining why. And what I mean by that is this. When I'm in this MFA in creative writing, you try to teach an English composition class and it's like, no, you must teach this book and you must teach this. And what is your reason for this? And what is your reason for that? At the end of the day, if you're getting into something that's creative, now English composition is a little bit different, but if you're getting into film, at the end of the day, you want to watch something and you want to know why it's profound. Why is The Pianist a profound film? Why is Battleship Potemkin a profound film? Why is A Single Man, something that is much smaller than both of these movies, a profound film? And I think the problem is our universities get so caught up in, no, this movie is important, so it must be shown. Or this is what needs to be shared in a film school to teach this properly. That at the end of the day, it goes in one ear and out the other, because how does this movie, how does Battleship Potemkin help me to make the movie I want to make now? I don't want to make a movie that's like Battleship Potemkin, though. But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I'm saying. How does it do that? Now, their answer is, well, it's just something you need to know. You need to know how it's groundbreaking. There is plenty in Battleship Potemkin to pull from it to make a modern film. This movie's 97 years old, and there is plenty to pull from it to make a modern film. But that's not expressed in film schools and the like. And that's my biggest problem with universities, because I watched the Odessa Steppe scene and it felt like the professor was just like, well, frick, I got to do it. I don't have a choice. I've seen the eyeball cutting scene from whatever the goat movie, whatever the hell it's called. I forget what it's called. The Buñuel movie. I've seen that. There's no explanation for why that's happening. We don't know. When you sit there and watch Rome Open City, you're like, yeah, the Italians were sad. Oh, okay. That's all we know. There's no bringing it back full circle. Why is Battleship Potemkin so powerful and why does it work despite the fact that it is a pro-communist, as I found out 7 minutes ago, a pro-communist Russian film? Why is it still work? Why is it still revered as one of the all-time classics, one of the most important films in cinema history, when it's a pro-communist propaganda film? We don't get that when we're being taught these things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, like, you can see it here. I have a pretty good knowledge of film. I had no idea this was pro-communist because I don't know the time period. I don't know any of that. And there should be that explanation, because without knowing about the Holocaust, The Pianist doesn't matter. Yep. Without knowing about the Bolshevik Revolution and what's going on in Russia, this movie does not matter. It doesn't have the same impact. You need to have a basic understanding. Yeah, I took this movie totally the wrong way. I thought they were anti-communist, blah, blah, blah. But I was still able to feel the passion and the urgency that Sergei Eisenstein was putting into this, because I knew that they were trying to take down something and unite. Mm-hmm. I just thought that it was in the modern version of what you see in a Dr. Zhivago. But anyway, I digress. Go.
No, exactly. And I mean, I really benefited from, like I said, I watched this movie 8 times in my first 2 years of university. And that was in a bunch of different courses. I watched that in a history course. I watched it in multiple history courses. I watched it in multiple film studies courses. Like, these are movies. So I have so much context behind Battleship Potemkin that a lot of people don't. Because a lot of people who see Battleship Potemkin are film students. And they're being told to watch it because of the Odessa step scene. But they're not being told, like... But when I'm studying my Russian cinema course, I'm being told, yes, this is important because of this historical context. And also the fact that, like, we're talking about Soviet montage theory with this film. We're talking about the Kuleshov effect. And we're talking about some of these more groundbreaking things in this film, which really go to show why this movie is important. And it's like, you can show the Odessa steps. You, every single person listening to this podcast, whether you have watched Battleship Potemkin or not, has seen the Odessa steps. You might not have seen the original Odessa steps, but this scene is in so many different films.
Yeah.
You have absolutely, there is no way any person who has ever watched more than 10 movies in their life hasn't seen this scene.
Yeah. At least a part of it. I mean, I laugh about this because anybody who's a fan of Stephen Merchant had the show on HBO about 10 years ago called Hello Ladies. And in Hello Ladies, it's, you know, it's the typical office cringe humor. It's meant, you know, it's the uncomfortable humor. And in that thing, she has a girl's night. And she decides that instead of just having a basic girls' night, she wants to elevate their, you know, whatever. We're gonna be intelligent. We're not just gonna watch a chick flick and whatever. And they sit down and watch this movie. And that scene is in that show that's on HBO. That's a cringe humor show. Like, so I know it's in everything. Like, it is all over the place because it's something that's very easy to show. You get a lot of, like, panic. You get the guy with one leg hopping around. You get the guy with no legs running around. Like, there's so much happening in this scene that can be used in context of chaos and all of that, but it really is, it's just fantastic filmmaking. However, it disregards the rest of the movie, which to me sucks, because this movie should always be watched from beginning to end. The Odessa steps are iconic, sure. They're iconic because we're told they're iconic.
Yeah.
There are so many other moments in this movie that absolutely would work. This movie should be shown in its entirety from beginning to end. That's just how it should be. It shouldn't.
It's only an hour and 10 minutes. Just do it.
That's what I'm saying. But I'm telling you, man, it's black and white. It's silent. The biggest problem, here you go. I'll say it. The biggest problem is a lot of the people teaching film don't want to be teaching film. They want to be making films. And then they end up just teaching film. And so they just do whatever's on the syllabus. They get it out of the way and they go home. That's not every teacher. There's some teachers who are really passionate about what they do. But a lot of teachers, they're just doing it because they have to. And especially in these history type classes of film, a lot of times it's thrown to a student or to like a GA or something like that who doesn't really know what they're doing or is just learning it. And that's what they're doing. It's just how it is. Like, I'm sorry, but this is a movie that should be explained to 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds the importance of it, because not for nothing. Battleship Potemkin, The Pianist, two movies we watched this week. And guess what? I'm going to talk about The Birth of a Nation in a little bit because it's worth talking about. Like, it really is. What was the other one I watched? The one that was actually the best one I watched this week, John. What was my other Letterboxd movie? It's not coming to mind, but it will.
It was Northman, wasn't it?
Oh, The Northman. Freaking awesome movie. Like, what do these movies all have in common? Whether you agree with what they're doing or not, because let's be real, there are some questionable things in The Birth of a Nation, which I don't think John has seen. You need to watch it, John. It's seriously very much worth a watch. But every one of these movies is about a period in time that none of us were alive for. Yes, I understand that, you know, obviously the Holocaust and all of that. That was something that at the time of this movie, there were a lot more people alive who had experienced that. Now we're on the tail end of it where we're getting to the point where pretty much anybody who was cognizant during that time has either passed away or is very, very old. And so we're not, it's not as, you know, it's not something that we're necessarily like seeing people who experience this. But all of these movies tell about injustice. And they tell about one point of view that is, this is bad and it must change. How do we make it better? how do I get my revenge? How do I get, like, every one of these movies ultimately is about revenge. I mean, obviously The Pianist, not so much, but his survival is revenge, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But you need to know the context and the history. Because nowadays, when a movie gets made, John Wick's a great movie. Don't get me wrong. Love John Wick. But everybody who tries to replicate a John Wick, why do I care? Yes, and, right? Like, it's the whole joke about in BoJack Horseman about Scientology. Yes, and, like, you know, because they're making fun of improv. But, okay, yeah, that's a great movie. But why? What is it that this movie is trying to state? And we live right now in a time period where there are two distinct sides to everything, every single thing. And I'm not going to say my political beliefs on anything. You guys can assume and you can be wrong or right. I don't care. But you look at something like in America, and I know that this has made its way to John, who lives in Canada and doesn't, I don't even think, is affected by this. Maybe I'm wrong. But Roe versus Wade. Look at what's happening with this right now. There are two very distinct sides to this. But how do people, if they're going to make a film about this, how do you tell your story? How do you tell your story about your moment in history? And how do you make it powerful and impactful and make it mean something to audiences 97 years later? How do you do that? I think we are very much in a generation that doesn't know how to do that. I think we are in a generation that is very much struggling to figure out how to say these things. Battleship Potemkin is propaganda, and yet there's an art to it. Sometimes we see things that are just too over the top, hitting you on the head, and it's not 1925 anymore. Battleship Potemkin would have to have more of a story if it was made now. However, there's a lot of movies that are just being made now that aren't getting the point across they want to get across because they're getting the point across too directly and not actually making a greater statement about something. Yeah. This movie needs to be taught that way so people understand the statement rather than blacking out, canceling, pretending it didn't exist with The Birth of a Nation. That movie should be studied because people should understand why would D.W. Griffith feel this way? And how do we correct this? How do we make things better, not worse? How do we make things better without hatred? And I think that is what is missing in the context of a lot of this stuff. And obviously I'm more passionate now because you had to correct me on this after I just watched the movie and thought all week I knew what the movie was about and I didn't. But I just think that's missing so often. And that is what it takes to make a great movie. If you're going to make a great movie about the Trump era, it better not have Trump with fake teeth. Vice is not a great movie because it makes fun of George Bush and Dick Cheney. That doesn't make a great movie. Whatever that garbage movie that Adam McKay did this year is called with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence. Whatever it's called. Don't Look Up. Thank you. I wanted to call it This Is the End, which that would be an insult to This Is the End.
Yeah.
But that's not clever. Like, you're not saying anything. What can you say? And I think that we need to look at these old movies and rather than say, look at how this movie changed the history of filmmaking, we need to say, look at how it influenced storytelling. Look at how it influenced a society into thinking a certain way. Look how this director got his message across because he suffered under the czarist rule. I think that is what is missing from a lot of this stuff and why this movie, you know, ultimately is great.
Yeah, I mean, historical context is so important for film, just like any art, right? When we're looking at art, we need to know the historical context that is going into any form of art, whether it be visual art, dance, film, literature, whatever. There is so much that influences it that you have to pay attention to in order to fully grasp it. And what I feel Battleship Potemkin does is, like you said, you thought you knew what this film was about. You still understood the story of it for the most part. You understood the emotions that you were supposed to feel about the film. Does now knowing that this is communist propaganda change your outlook on the film at all? And whether or not it accomplishes its goal?
Not at all. And I think that's what's amazing about it. Because what's fun. Okay, so I don't think that this is like a necessarily controversial thing to say in America, because I think, you know, doesn't matter what side of the line you're on, you're probably thinking this in America. Very anti-communist guy sitting here talking to you right now, like very much. Like, sorry if that offends anybody, but I am, and I don't care. That should if that offends you, too bad. But I'm big on separating the art from whatever it's like, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Like, same thing with The Birth of a Nation. The movie, yeah, it's dated as all hell. It's 107 years old. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything that's 107 years old is going to stink, but it accomplishes what it's trying to accomplish, and it does it in a pretty good way. Battleship Potemkin, no. To me, what's amazing about this movie is, even though it's pro-communist, you sit down, you watch this movie, there are characters who are suffering at the hands of people that are more powerful than them. They are forced to work for these people for minimal, and they have to survive. Now, they finally have somebody who is willing to stand up and say, screw this, I've had enough. They fight back. They get the power, and now the people join them. And yet the people and these people who are protesting still don't have the power over the government, who is in control of all of the military. The military comes out, it executes people blindly for no reason, and then finally it's going to go and destroy this ship. And they let them go because that was the final thing that they could do. I just said the whole story of Battleship Potemkin. It doesn't matter what this movie is pro or anti. At the end of the day, this movie is about struggle and overcoming and trying to get better than the government that you're living in the moment. Everybody, they say it, I think, in Before Sunset. Everybody thinks that they're living in the worst time period. It always feels the worst. It has progressively gotten better. Everybody thinks it's the worst, though, just because they're living it. They're experiencing it, and everything else they haven't experienced. This movie says to you, man, what would I do in that situation? And me, if I was being fed maggoty meat, I guess I'm pro-communist then. Like, let's go. Like mm-hmm. I want to get out of this. So I think that's what's powerful about this movie. It doesn't matter what it actually meant in 1925. It does, but it doesn't. It matters, can it still mean something now? And it absolutely 1,000% does.
And a lot of that comes down to the fact that these themes are still themes we see discussed mm-hmm. daily nowadays, right? Like, we are seeing record amounts of unions sprouting up in the States right now. And, like, this is exactly what this type of movie is talking about, is, like, this struggle of, like, oppression versus the oppressed and what the people can do to fight against back mm-hmm. against it. It's... this movie is just timeless.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, this movie is timeless because that struggle is always going to exist.
Yeah.
In an ideal future, we don't have that struggle anymore. But for the foreseeable future, definitely have that struggle. And the way Eisenstein presents it, using Soviet montage theory, because Eisenstein is not the founder of montage.
Might as well be.
Obviously, that was... obviously, it was Kuleshov and everything, but what?
Sorry, everybody. I have to interrupt you, John. Obviously, guys. Obviously.
Obviously, that was Kuleshov.
Yeah, obviously.
but Eisenstein had this theory that he ran with when it came to montage, and montage wasn't about processing the images one after another, but on top of each other instead. Yeah. Whereas in, like, each successive image you have is processed with the image that precedes it. And that is how you get this emotion out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there is one ridiculous montage sequence when the Potemkin shoots at the Odessa theater. And then we get the lions.
Yeah.
Like, the lion reactions. It's hilarious, but it feels so wonderful at the same time because you just feel everything that's going on because of what precedes it and how it gets to that point.
Yeah.
And that is exactly why film schools always show the Odessa steps, because you get the sequence of the soldiers marching to the top of the steps. You have the chaos happening on the steps. You have the stroller going down. You have the woman getting shot in the face. All of it put together gives you the exact emotion Eisenstein is trying to capture in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, like, I also think that this creates an interesting question, though. Think about Dr. Zhivago, which comes out, what, 50 years later?
Yeah.
40 years later, because it was 1965, I believe, or something like that. 40 years later, it comes out, anti-communist, about the same exact thing. Because it's told from the eyes of Dr. Zhivago, who comes home after the war and it's not his house anymore. No, no, no. We share it. You're not, no, you don't welcome us. We welcome you.
Yeah.
And I think what's fascinating is, because you were talking about it, maybe one day we won't have to worry about this. We'll never get there. Because at the end of the day, once you get what you think you want, now you have the power. Now you want to use that power. And guess what? Using power normally leads to abuse of power. Communism sounded like a great idea compared to the czarist rule. However, once Stalin came to power, it was no longer such a good idea because now he could abuse that power. We saw it in Cuba with Che and all of that stuff. And what's his name? Who for some reason is like Castro? In Miami. Thank you, Castro. Thank you. But like you see it, they fight, they live, they go through the revolution. Boom, everything's great. And then they abuse the power. That's the thing. And that's why it doesn't matter what this movie's about, because it's whoever's in power abuses the power. That's why I hate politics, because whoever's in power is going to abuse it. It doesn't matter who it is. They always do. It's been happening since the beginning of time, the pharaohs, whatever. Go back earlier. Doesn't matter. But I just think this movie does a really good job of showing like that buildup and overcoming that power. And then we know that it ultimately ends up not being that much better for the people of Russia after that. And I think that's also what's awesome now watching this 97 years later is that 40 years later, a movie about the same thing comes out and has a completely different message. And that's why I was confused watching this one. Like, it's awesome. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. This is sort of the magic of cinema throughout the years. Like, cinema is a new art form. Mm-hmm. It's only been around for like 120 years at this point. Like, this is new in the grand scheme of the world. This is the oldest film we have on either of our lists. It's almost 100 years old, but it still has that impact today. Like, all of these, nearly a century later, a time period that it seems so unfathomable for so many people to actually comprehend how short in the long scheme of things that is. But for most of us, that's more than three times our lifespan so far. And it's wild to think that this movie, this short, simple movie with a very simple plot, yet a very fleshed out plot at the same time, that can distinctly give us unique characters that are so distinct, you can tell exactly what they're purpose is in the film. You can tell who they are when you see them, despite the fact that so many people are wearing the exact same clothes in this film.
Yep.
It's clear. It gets its themes across. It inspires you to, you know, try and make life better for yourself. And that's exactly what the purpose of this film was when it was released in 1925.
Yeah. So you said something cool there, and I'm going to move into the next segment, because Battleship Potemkin landed, John. Thank you. It did.
One question. Right,
one more thing, and then I'm going to say something.
Did you watch this on Canopy?
I did.
Okay, so you watched the restored version from 2007, then?
Did I watch
this? Did it have English
intertitles? I watched this on HBO Max.
Ooh, did it have English or Russian intertitles?
Russian.
Okay. Interesting.
I watched the Russian with the English subtitle for all of it.
Interesting, because I watched it on Canopy, which is the Criterion Collection version of it, and it is the restoration, which actually has gone back to the original score. If you were watching in Russian, you were probably watching...
I have to remember. I don't know.
Because this is the first time I've ever watched the restoration. I've only ever watched like the 50th anniversary re-release, which has the Shostakovich score instead than the original Mizell score. And this one, it felt better.
You know what the biggest
thing... I love going back to that original score.
You know what the biggest thing to note is, John, when you talk to me about this kind of thing? I only read the English parts.
Of course.
To me, it was all in English because I read it. I mean, it was there.
Right.
But I don't remember, but I feel like it was Russian with the English. I don't know. But then again, I did watch two other movies that had interstitials this week, and they were in whatever weird thing, whatever the... hell the Northman is doing. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. It would be the first time, but maybe I am. I don't know. But I want to jump ahead real quick and let's go into what the best thing we watched this week was. But I'm going to start with mine because I've already talked about my movies. But it's funny you said that thing about 97 years ago. Think about what we did, blah, 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 but how young film is as a medium. I watched The Birth of a Nation this week. It is the oldest film I've ever seen. Yeah, I've seen, you know, the whatever, the train pulling into the station. It's not a film. Yeah. It's a train pulling into a station.
The Great Train Robbery and stuff.
Yeah, all that. But in terms of feature length, and I think there's maybe only like four or five surviving films that are older than this one. I watched it this week. It was the oldest movie I've ever seen. It was 107 years old. How many books has every single person who is listening to this podcast, who is on YouTube, read that are over 107 years old? A lot. A lot. A lot. And I think that's so fascinating about how far film has come, because it's 107 years old. And this is why I am anti-censorship out the ass. I don't care what it is. I literally don't care. I'm anti-censorship. I think censorship is the worst thing we could do, because I think you learn from everything through the past. Not for nothing. Most of what I know, probably 80% of what John knows, I'm more like 95%, comes from movies. Because you learn about history through movies. You learn about through a movie like The Pianist, you're going to learn about, you know, World War II, Battleship Potemkin. You're going to learn about Russian wars and all of that. But The Birth of a Nation doesn't stand the test of time anymore. It wasn't going to. Intolerance, which came out a year later, it's amazing that D.W. Griffith did these in back-to-back years. Intolerance is a phenomenal movie. Intolerance is a better movie. However, what The Birth of a Nation really did for me was it really made me go back and look at a time in American history that nobody talks about and nobody looks at. And that's the Reconstruction era. Now, I didn't go back and look at that because I was like, man, he's telling me the Klan has a reason. And that means the Klan had a reason. No, that's not why I went back and looked at it. I went back and looked at it because the period after the Civil War in American history is never talked about. It is never discussed. We just skip ahead. Let's just move into like the Industrial Revolution and all that. So we don't need to worry about this. The Reconstruction era in American history is not talked about in America because it was a shitty time, because we did a really bad job. And The Birth of a Nation made me go and watch, or and not watch, but look up a lot more about the Reconstruction era in American history. And it was a lot of stuff I didn't know. And it is crazy. It is crazy to think that a lot of that stuff isn't far from what people are claiming is happening now. And it's 107, you know, whatever, 140 years later. And I think that's why films should never be censored. Books, films, whatever. Granted, if it's just blatantly like a, you know, racist snuff film, yeah, there's no purpose for that. But this movie was told, D.W. Griffith says it in every interstitial. I didn't mean it. This is not meant to be anything except what happened. Okay. And then he uses words where you're like, sure. You didn't mean for that to happen. But I think it's worth watching. You can watch it with absolute disgust, but it also is very interestingly told from the point of view that we never, ever, ever, ever get in American cinema, or really in cinema in general. That's all I'm going to say about that movie. I gave it 2.5 stars. It's long as hell. The first half is very well done. The second half is well done, except everything about it is insanely racist. Everything. Watch it, be disgusted, but learn about American history, because there's a lot in that movie that'll get you thinking, wait, there's no way this is real. Let me go look this up. And you look stuff up. That's it. Just do your own research. However, I still think that there's a purpose for movies. It's 107 years old. Thank God movies weren't able to be made in 1865. That's all I'll say. There's a reason why we progressed as slow as we did as human beings. That being said, The Northman is a freaking masterpiece. I loved that movie so much. I can't wait to watch it again. Might be the loudest movie I've ever seen in my life. Yes. Everything was so loud, but the score is amazing. I love the violence. Robert Eggers just has a phenomenal eye for direction. I gave it 4 stars. Would not be surprised if I watched this a couple more times and it ends up being my new Revenant, where it pops up and everything else gets kicked off. Love the supernatural. Loved all of it. My favorite movie that I've seen this year, because it's the only movie I've seen this year, but my favorite movie that I've seen since 2020, since The Father, yep, for sure. So what do you got?
What do I got? I saw The Northman. I talked about it last week, but like, yeah, that movie's incredible. Eggers, just, you know, a he's proven that he's not a fluke. He is very good.
He has proven that. That's for sure. He proves that he knows his history, and I think that's why it's important.
Yep. I watched a few things this week. I finally watched Brokeback Mountain for the first time. Mm. Movie's good. I'm sorry, Phil. I fall on the Brokeback Mountain side of the argument.
I told you Brokeback Mountain is a 4-star movie. I just said
you did. You did. I personally prefer it than Crash. Great movie. Incredible performances. I was blown away by it. Not the best movie I watched this week, though. I watched Ryuzuki Hamaguchi's other 2021 film this week, Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, and that was such a fascinating film to watch, especially after watching Drive My Car. It's very clear Hamaguchi has this love for slow cinema, so obviously I love everything that he makes. Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting because it's three short stories essentially in the film, each like kind of focusing on like relationships and love and connections with people. It was really fascinating. Hamaguchi just has that wonderful time where he just takes his time on every shot and just lets conversation happen without going away from who's speaking, without looking at reactions or anything like that, just focusing on what's happening. It's a beautiful film. Just got added to Canopy. Highly recommend.
I'll check it out because I did like Drive My Car. Didn't love Drive My Car. Wasn't like a John level fan of it, but I did like it, so I'll definitely check it out. I was wondering what that was. Not going to lie, I didn't click on it when I saw your review, but I was like, what is that movie that he watched? Like, what is this thing, John? Like, what are you doing? But that totally makes sense that it was the other Hamaguchi, considering you love that guy now. So
I do. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump over to the penis because now, you know, we're at 41 minutes and we got to talk for a half hour about this.
Yeah.
So here we go. So The Pianist from 2002, my favorite World War II movie. I think it's the best made one. The reason why I go with a movie like this over a Schindler's List, and I know Schindler's List is, you know, the one that's the best revered and all that. And it was Spielberg. And I continue to go back to this movie. Schindler's List is too hard for me to watch. Yeah. This movie, and maybe that makes it more powerful and a better movie, but I still think that this movie has an unbelievable amount of realism in it. It doesn't shy away from anything. Me and John were actually talking about this because John had mentioned to me that it's so hard to rate Nazis as villains in movies because you just expect them to do the worst thing, so you're numb to it. Polanski knew you were numb to it. Mm-hmm. Spielberg cut away a lot. You know, you would see the ash coming up, which, you know, it's maybe a little bit more poetic. But when those guys are laying on the ground on their faces and they all get shot in the back of the head and we don't get a single cut, and then the only cut we do get is to show the guy when he's reloading the gun so that the guy can look up at him, it's brilliant. The other thing with this movie is, and why it's, this was the little story I wanted to tell him, why it's so full circle and why it's actually hilarious, the timing of this, and we'll talk about that in a second. So this was the last real movie, and by real movie, I mean, you know, drama, whatever, that I watched before America shut down for COVID. And yeah, you want to talk about building your freaking anxiety. So when me and Rachel eventually decided that we were going to leave California and go to Arizona to stay with her parents for a little while, that we were watching Finding Dory. But in terms of like a movie that we really sat down and watched it, we watched this, I think that Thursday night or something like that, or that Wednesday night, and the world shut down that Friday, at least in Los Angeles. Everything shut down that Friday. And I remember at the time watching this movie and just being like, no, like this is what I'm scared of. Like, this is what I'm worried about. I'm worried about, you know, we're going to start with this. We're going to start small. We're going to start small. We're going to start small. And we're going to build up. And eventually we're going to have no power. And we're just going to, you know, we're just going to exist. That's what I was scared of. And you want to talk about paranoia to sit down and watch this movie and then 2 days later be told that your government is shutting everything down. Whew, that is a frightening thing. I'm not Jewish, but that was frightening.
Yeah.
But I find it unbelievable that this movie timed up And we couldn't have done this on purpose. We had weeks off. We had weeks where we did two movies. We had 2 weeks off. We did whatever. This movie timed up perfectly with me finishing out an incredibly hard year of work because it was just, you know, everything just ended. I'm about to get into my wedding. And today, the day that we are talking about this, the EU just announced that they are lifting masks on their airplanes, which almost makes this come as full circle as it possibly can, because the airplanes were like, have been the last thing that have really held on to a lot of masks and things like that. That's as close to full circle as you can come from beginning of pandemic to end of pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I just found it unbelievable that this lined up that perfectly because of the stress I felt after watching this the last time I watched it, to how therapeutic in a weird way it almost felt of like, we're coming out the other side of this. And ultimately, and I'm not trying to compare myself to this movie, obviously, but ultimately what this movie, and it's, you know, based on the, I think the memoir by Wally Spielman, I think he wrote the book. Okay. Ultimately what this is about is, he went through every single atrocity he could go through, and he managed to continue to survive just based on luck, good graces of random people, timing, all that stuff. And he made it through. And like, this is where I say, we always think we're living in the worst time. You watch this movie and you realize, I'm not living in the worst time. Not for me. No way. I'm not even close to what this guy went through and his family went through and the Jewish population of Poland went through. Not even close. But it was so surreal to me. When I looked at the calendar, I said, wait, that's going to line up with the first week that I have entirely off from sporting events that I've been working nonstop at, you know, 80 hours a week. No way. It's just crazy. And it's literally, we're talking about the day that the EU announced that they're going to lift masks. It's just so weird to me. But anyway, go ahead, John. Talk about the movie. Now that I gave my speech about this, the birth of a nation, all this shit. Shut me the hell up and go.
I really agree. This is the first time I've watched The Pianist, and it's been one that's like kind of been on my radar for a while. I just never got around to it. It's a really impactful movie. Mm-hmm. Like, Adrian Brody's performance is fantastic, but what Polanski does, I'm really glad we talked about Repulsion last week and Polanski's use of the, like the setting to depict the deterioration of the mental state, because we see it again in this film, but it's like the actual deterioration of Warsaw with Spielman, like all of his life and everything, but like, we see him degrading as Warsaw degrades. And like, it really goes to show where Polanski came from when we look at Repulsion, where it leads to with The Pianist. This, like you said, this movie is unafraid to move away from those terrifying moments of, like, you know, what Nazis do.
What they did, yeah.
What they did, what they do, and everything. And more importantly, World War II films really fascinate me because we all know the outcome of World War II. Mm-hmm. Hopefully everyone understands how World War II concluded at this point. But a lot of the times when we have these films and we understand like what happens after the conclusion of what the film is, there feels like there's really lesson stakes. World War II films never feel like that. Mm-hmm. Because at any point, these characters can all just die.
Absolutely.
And I'm so glad I didn't realize this was based on his memoirs until after I finished watching the film. Because like, there is not a single point in this movie where you're watching this without that knowledge that you don't think, oh, he's done for.
Yeah. And to create a story the way... like. Had we seen up to this point, and I know we've seen Life is Beautiful, but I just rewatched Life is Beautiful. These movies aren't even in the same freaking ballpark. I mean, it's the foot rub, you know, whatever. It's not even close. Had there been a movie that was told entirely from the point of view of a Jew that was working from pre-Holocaust into the actual Holocaust, Was this the first movie they did that? Because I think about Schindler's List. It's told from the point of view of Oscar Schindler.
Yeah.
So Oscar Schindler has the control. He's deciding mm-hmm. what's happening here. In this movie, Spielman has no control. He has no knowledge of what's going on outside. And I think that's what makes this movie all the more terrifying, because it's claustrophobic. You're him the mm-hmm. entire movie. Now, I knew it was a memoir. Obviously, I've seen it 100 times, but even when I watched it the first time, I knew it was a memoir. You still feel the suffering and the pain and all that the entire movie, because you're with him every step of the way. Polanski yeah. is a master of this, for anybody who's mm-hmm. not sure of this. Chinatown, Jack Nicholson is in every single scene. The Pianist, pretty sure that Adrian Brody is in every single scene. I'd have to rewatch it again, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, okay, there's going to be shots where he's not in, but I'm pretty sure every scene he is in some way, and we are seeing it from his point of view. That's unbelievably hard to do, but that's why this movie compels me so much, and why it manages to keep the intensity up so high, even though I knew what the outcome was going to be. Man, we're watching him go from we have everything to we have less, to we have less, to we have nothing, to my whole family is gone, to now I really am just starving and I'm not even living. I'm a rat in a cage at this point. Like, mm-hmm. there's nothing I can do. It's brutal. Like, it's just a brutal depiction of this. And I don't know if we'd seen this up to this point. Had we?
Nothing really comes to mind of, like, a Jewish protagonist navigating the entire extent of the war like we see in this film.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes beginning to end. It's the whole entire thing from the moment he's playing the piano and they get the first bombs dropped all the way until he's eventually rescued by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's such an emotional journey to go through, because it's just a story of survival. And like mm-hmm. that's what I think a lot of people will watch this movie and not realize, that this is just a survival movie. This is what did this person, this human being who went through this experience, have to do to ensure they could survive this 5-year period.
Well, and so what I love, though, about the survival aspect of this, so many survival movies are human versus nature. You know, mm-hmm. you think about The Revenant. He gets yep. left behind, but then it's him versus nature. How does he get back? So many of these revenge, Apocalypto even works. You know what I mean? Like these yep. types of movies. This movie is a survival movie entirely at the hands of other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And even in, like, you know, we've seen movies obviously with that, but like, this is like 12 Years a Slave. All yes. of it could have been avoided if human beings just cared about other human beings. That's how it could have been avoided. And again, that's why I go back to my speech earlier. Censorship is bad. Learn, watch it, yeah. be disgusted, so that you never, ever, you want to have that. What does he say? Alex DeLarge in A Clockwork Orange, he had the sicky feeling or something, whatever he says. You want to have mm-hmm. that, because you should. And watching a movie like The Pianist, it's brutal. It's so hard to watch, because at the end of the day, you know the outcome for most of these characters the first time they come on screen. You know the yep. father's going to die. You know the mother's going to die. You know that bad things are going to happen to everybody, and there's nothing they can do to stop it. And now it's about his survival, all because other human beings were terrible. And how does he survive at the end? Because a human being offers him a lending hand. That's how he survives, because you can't do it without it. And that's why this was such a helpless situation for the Jews during this time, because there was nobody to lend the helping hand. We hear it in this when the father says, I blame the Americans. Like, they should have been here. They should be doing more. They're not doing anything. I think that is that's what makes this movie so horrifying and makes Spielman such a good character to watch throughout.
I'm sorry, I missed everything you just said because my headphones decided to turn off.
Oh, that's fine. You don't need to know. I was just talking cool. about Spielman and all that
yeah,
stuff.
The interesting thing about this film is, like, I really enjoy the fact that it never really dives into Spielman's relationships with any of these characters, and that it just focuses so much on Spielman. It's like we get enough to understand his relationships with those characters, and to understand how they impact him when things happen to them. But there's no focus on it because that's never the focus of this film. This focus is all on Spielman and how he's struggling to survive through all of these different escalating issues that occur.
Well, and I think too, like when it comes to the relationships, you're not thinking about it. Like how often do you actually think about familial relationships? You don't, especially like in this time period where you're living with the people and everything like that. You're not thinking about the relationships with the people that you live with every day. You're thinking about relationships outside, you know, which we see a little bit more with the guy who's trying to get him work and the guy who does, you know, the guy who helps him get the brick thing and the police officer and all that. But a lot of times direct family just leads to frustrations. You want to go live your own life, whatever. And we see that scene when they're walking towards the train where the sister says, I wish I knew you better. He says, I wish I knew you better.
Yeah.
She says, thank you. But like you live together, but you don't know, because what does it matter at the end of the day? At the end of the day, you just do what you do. And yeah, your family's going to frustrate you. But we see not necessarily the relationship with the other people, but we see their personalities. And the brother, they'll never, you know, he's fight. And the dad, no, they're never going to get to that point. It's never going to get to that point. No, now you have to wear an armband. No, now you have to do this. And again, like being that this was the first movie or the last movie I watched before COVID really broke out and everything started shutting down. First, it was we shut down. Then it was, okay, it's 30 days. Then it was longer. Then it was masks. Then it was this, and it just kept going and go. And I was like, wait a second, when's it going to come back? Because The Pianist is a perfect example of that slippery slope. Once they took one thing, that was it. And there's that great line later in the movie where they say, it's ending now. Nobody thought it would happen, but the Jews are standing up. The ones who fought, the people who died in that building, it's, oh, what did they die for? Blah, blah, blah. They died and it inspired people to fight back. And for so long, there was no fighting back. We hear them at the one part. We outnumber them 5-1 or 10-1, whatever it is. Yeah. What are we going to do? Well, we're just going to get killed. You're old. How are we going to do this? It doesn't matter. It's that feeling when you're human, the fear of death is always greater than the fear of like breaking free, you know? And I think that this movie expresses that so well, though, because it does bounce into the heads of the other characters, but it focuses on a character who's like, I'm just going to do things right. Leave me alone. Let me live my life. Who's not able to do that because it's impacted, but he doesn't have strong beliefs one way or the other. Normally, you want your protagonist to have very strong beliefs one way or the other because that makes them more compelling. This movie works better because Spielman does not have as strong of beliefs and he just wants to live.
Yes. Yeah. It's that intrinsic drive for life and for survival that really propels the movie, because we're not seeing his opinions, because we don't need to see his opinions.
No.
Because again, going back to what you said, I said before, Nazis are bad.
Yeah.
We all know that. We don't need a character's opinions on what Nazis are doing because we know they're bad. So by Polanski deciding to completely neglect that aspect of it and focus more on the survival aspect, it's now different than every other film about a similar subject ever made.
Exactly. And it is, it's more jarring at the end when the Nazi is good to him than anything you see in the entire movie, because everything you see in the entire movie is what you expect. But when the Nazi is good to him, you're like, well, wait a second. What's this cat and mouse game? What's he going to do? And he just lets them live there. He just lets them live because he knows that they're going to lose. And I think a lot of times too, like we saw Cabaret. Like I love Cabaret. Cabaret gets into pre-Nazi Germany, you know, as it's coming into effect with Schindler's List. It's already there, but it's from the point of view of a German. So what is that? You know, it's different. This movie really deals with the start of the power of the Nazis. But then it goes far enough that it actually explores what was it like when they knew they were going to lose. If you haven't checked out a movie, a good movie comparison to this one is Downfall. Phenomenal movie. If you haven't seen it, for anybody who's out there, it's about the last days of Hitler's life. It is incredible. It is absolutely incredible. Watch it. You won't regret it. It is a phenomenal movie. And we so rarely see the Nazis at the point where they're losing. We see in Life is Beautiful, you know, oh, they're burning everything because of this, that, whatever. But we don't see them really admitting it. They're still like, you know, they're still Nazis. In this movie, we start to see them as something else. And and that's very rare. And I think that's a very interesting thing that Polanski's able to pull off.
You raise a really good point, because a lot of the times we don't see Nazis as they're losing. We see allies as they're winning.
It's a good point. Yeah. It's a good way to put it.
And like, that's the way it's usually portrayed to us. So when we get that glimpse into, because Nazis, like I said, Nazis are bad, but like, not everyone in the German military was a Nazi. And like, that's something that's often forgotten when we're talking about World War II, is that a lot of these people were just doing their job. They were forced into it. They didn't believe with it, that what they were doing. But their alternative goes back again to survival, right? Their alternative is death at that point. So when we see compassion from these characters, yes, it's taking our preconceived notions of a Nazi and shifting it on its head when we get to the end of this film. But that's what makes it impactful, because in the end, we're looking at people here, right? Yes, the higher ups in this film who are, you know, making people lie down on the street and shooting them in the back of the head, they were the real bad guys. Mm-hmm. But we don't often focus on the everyday German who was in this war and had to live after this war.
Well, and I always think, and you know, I always go back to the scene in Cabaret, one of my all-time favorite scenes, when they're singing that song, and it slowly pans out to show the guy, it's a kid who's a Nazi. And everybody's singing along with him, and he turns to Michael York, and he says, you still think that they don't have the power to do this, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
What happens throughout history, like, you see it, right? Like, okay, that was very popular. George Bush invading Iraq and Afghanistan, whatever else he invaded, was also insanely popular when it happened. Insanely popular. People want to forget that they supported that decision. Just like people want to forget that they might have supported the Nazi Party. I'm sure they felt that way in the 50s.
Yep.
People try to forget that stuff. And again, I just keep going back to learn from it, learn from it, learn from it, learn from it. Don't be disowned because you had a bad stance at some point. If you know when to jump off the freaking ship. And what was very popular at one time, 2 years later, all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a second. If they're exterminating an entire race, air quotes, of people, maybe I shouldn't be on their side. I'm leaving that. The biggest problem is, it's the fear that if the Nazis, who were just there because they had to be, and the Jews, who had the numbers, actually communicated, it all could have been stopped. However, there's that fear, like you said, if the Nazis do anything wrong, they get killed. If the Jews do anything wrong, they get killed. It's a lose-lose, but how do you get the courage to stand up to that? Battleship Potemkin's a movie that's about the courage to stand up to that. Yep. Hundreds die in that movie, maybe more. I don't know. They didn't have enough extras. But it's about that courage to stand up. And I think that is where a movie like Battleship Potemkin, which is about a revolutionary moment, is more willing to say, we're going to stand up, because they just had. With the pianist, they never did. And that's the scary part about it. If there was no intervention, it might have never, ever, ever, ever stopped. World War II, if the Germans win, what happens? These people are just murdered? That's it. And I think, like, I don't know. That's just like what I think about with these movies. Like, yeah, you bring up a good point. Not every Nazi was bad towards the end, because they were like, what are we doing? But then at that point, how do you leave? You can't. You can't leave. And so I just think, like, these perspectives and like talking about that kind of stuff is what's important, because, you know, there's a lot of things you're going to do at one point in your life that you're not going to agree with 10 years later. Hopefully, though, you didn't have to murder thousands and thousands and thousands of people in order to realize that you were doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
That's my profound thought.
For that. Exactly. And I mean, when we get back down to it, like, this movie's called The Pianist, and it's very powerful for us to be able to discuss art like this, and that, like, in the end, it's, you know, it's Spielman's playing of the piano and his art, which mm-hmm. really saves his life in the end. Mm-hmm. And it's that appreciation for art. And we're just so privileged to be able to talk about this and to look back on these moments and learn from them.
I love that scene where he plays the piano for the Nazi because he thinks he's going to die. He thinks this is the last time he's ever going to play. And he just plays it with all his heart. Everything he had built up over those years, he does everything he can because he thinks it's the last time he's ever going to play the piano. And this is going to be his last act on Earth. Then he doesn't get killed. What almost mm-hmm. kills him is the fact that he wore a jacket that was given to him out of a gesture of kindness.
Yeah.
That almost gets him killed. But I think that's a great moment. The direction is great. But I do want to mention before we, you know, jump out, because we'll probably go like 5 more-ish minutes. But Adrien Brody's performance in this is so amazing. And it's very fascinating to see the types of people who work with Polanski. Mm-hmm. Polanski has a hard time getting actors to work with him for obvious reasons. There was a brief period where he did Carnage, and, you know, that was great. But if you really think about it, like Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, after that, who was really willing to work with him? And then we get to this movie. Adrien Brody's a household name now. In my opinion, Adrien Brody's also a one-hit wonder. Mm-hmm. I think he's had some good performances. The Grand Budapest Hotel, he's phenomenal in that. You know, he's had some good ones, Darjeeling Limited. But this is the only thing people really know him for. What's that guy's name? And he won the Oscar for this. And how many people passed up this role because it was Polanski? Or how did Polanski land on Adrien Brody? And how did that align? I think Adrien Brody was like 26 or 27 at the time of this movie. He was very young. And he got this. He wins the Oscar. And it's like, whoa, where did that come from? When he's got the jaundice and what he does with the jaw and he just the way he walks, the way he moves, it is an absolutely incredible performance. Well-deserved Oscar. It's a shame that he never really got a leading role like this again. Tried to do the movie The Jacket with, was it Keira Knightley? Nobody cared, but like Detachment.
He was in that Peter Jackson King Kong movie as the lead.
That movie didn't have a lead. So I loved that movie, and I can tell by your reaction that you don't really like it.
It's been a while since I've seen it.
Love that movie. But that's Naomi Watts, Kyle Chandler, Adrien Brody, Jack Black.
Yeah.
It's got so many leads in that movie. And then, I mean, you could argue that Andy Serkis as Kong is the lead.
That movie. Yeah, like, that's true.
There's so many people in that. So that was more of a
ensemble.
And that was only 3 years later. After that, Adrien Brody kind of vanished. But all that's to say, it's a great performance. Polanski does a great job directing it. And I can't help but keep drawing the parallels here because it's just funny to me how time just keeps going, huh? You think about everything that Roman Polanski did in his life, what he was alleged to do, what he did do, whatever. And then you look at a movie like The Pianist, and it's a beautiful movie. It's an artistic movie. It is a profound movie. It is maybe the most or second most devastating portrayal of what it was like to be Jewish during the Holocaust. And this movie to me almost feels like he's trying to gain some sort of atonement, something. He wants something. He wants some sort of forgiveness. And I go all the way back to the other movie I watched this week, The Birth of a Nation, where he made that movie. It was so, 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 so controversial. And it led to the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, which obviously is not good. And D.W. Griffith, weird. It was like there was interviews with him during the Canopy thing. You could tell that he was not happy with that. So like, I feel like in his heart, there was racism, but not as much racism as that movie portrayed. And the next year he makes movie Intolerance, which is 4 stories about love and overcoming and hatred and how it ruins and how you can overcome that. And it's just, to me, I say this all the time, but every director, every artist, every actor, every actress, they have something that they're going to have done that you're not going to like. Now, some of them are going to be criminal, like Kevin Spacey, like Roman Polanski, all of that. Some of them, they're just going to make movies that you're disgusted by, like D.W. Griffith. However, can you separate the art from what is being made? The art from the artist. And I can. And I understand that some people can't. But I'm just thankful that I can. because it allows me to really appreciate a movie like The Pianist. When some people see Roman Polanski directed it, I will never look at it, because I think this is one of the, I have it as my number 38. I think it is one of the most important movies in the history of film. And it's only 20 years old. And I think it's only going to grow in importance as we move into an era where nobody who survived the Holocaust is still alive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's one of those films where it's a shame if people aren't willing to watch it because Polanski's name's attached to it. This is a movie that's worth watching. It's worth watching. It's, we see so many World War II movies about the conflict, and we never see enough about the actual suffering of the everyday people through World War II.
Yeah.
And while we have history courses in high schools and post-secondary showing like the opening invasion scene from Saving Private Ryan, this is the type of movie they should really be seeing if they really want to nail home what World War II was doing.
What the horrors were, what the terrifying, you didn't know when it, you, I just saved your life. Just keep walking. Don't run. You know what I mean? Spielman, what are you doing? Grabs him, throws him back. I just saved your life. Like those things, those moments, like he never sees his family again after that.
Yeah.
Never sees his family again after that.
In fact, he pretty much gets told they're dead.
Yeah. But that's the last thing that we get to see. And then we get to see the opposite side of it at the very end when Hosenfeld is sitting in the thing going, the pianist Spielman, is he there? I know Spielman, brings him back and he's not there. And all they know is he was killed in 1952.
Yeah.
I just think it's great. I think it's so powerful. And I think, I have no problem saying it's my favorite World War II movie. And I don't know how it's going to be topped, because what I love about it, there's no war. There didn't need to be a war. So many times we see a movie like Defiance, right? Or Fury or something like that. They always try to add in the war element, something to make it exciting. There shouldn't be excitement surrounding this.
No.
It should just be purely devastating. Mm-hmm. And a movie like Saving Private Ryan, it's a different movie. It's not trying to get into this. It's trying to get into the Americana of everything.
Yeah.
But as this movie says numerous times, and it's directed by a Pole, who obviously hates America because of everything. They say numerous times, I blame the Americans. Mm-hmm. Because how long did it take the Americans to actually get involved? A long time. And how many people died because of that? Now, they can't know that in the moment, just like there's stuff going on in other countries right now that we don't know necessarily the extent of. But I just think it's great. I also think what this movie does a great job of, and then I'll let you get your last closing statements in here so we can go. But I also think what this movie does a great job of is show the horrors of the battle being fought in your backyard, because American cinema like this normally follows the character as they go out into Europe, and it doesn't matter because who cares? Like All Quiet on the Western Front, we see it a little bit, but this movie with the explosions and the buildings going down and the wall being torn down and all that stuff, it gives you that fear and that, oh my God, like this was happening where they lived. Like there was no escaping this. I think it does a great job of that, and maybe the best depiction of that in film.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. It feels so much more grounded as a war film because it doesn't show conflict. And that's something that a lot of filmmakers can really learn a lesson from, is impactful characters and their motivations are so much more telling of a situation like this than just retelling events for action's sake.
Yep. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed watching these two movies. They sure are uppers. Next week, we actually are talking about a little bit more fairy tale-ish movies. Ordinary People from 1980, absolutely brutal. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from 2019. John's got Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I got Ordinary People. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was higher up on my list, though. So, you know, we'll be talking.
And we just can't go a week without talking about Roman Polanski, apparently.
I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. It's crazy. This is 3 weeks in a row that we're going to be talking about Polanski. We'll have to find a way to get him in there for the Seven Samurai Usual Suspects episode before we take a four-week hiatus. But yeah, thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with that one. And then we'll have one more week, and then we're going to take a long four-week break. But Still got 2 weeks left. So next week, Ordinary People and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. See y'all then.